Okay, so we are recording. Thank you very much for those of you that have decided to tune in. And I'm very sorry that the format of this classroom makes me talk from one side of the class to the other. I hope you're able to understand it. I mean, it's going to be very useful in order to talk about one of the typicalities that General American has. The upspeaking, and as always in this subject, I'm going to be feeding from different sources, okay? And I'm sorry that that is so hectic. I'm going to go to the last slides. Because I collected the different sources that I've used, and some of them I was already familiarized, and others I needed to check some of the information, so I think it's probably best to start by the end of the presentation and talk about where I think the information from. International English, what is supposed to be the course book, I basically take information from Unit 3, there are other sections, but if you read the notes by Silvia Barreiro regarding Unit 3, General American, it gives you the exact pages that we follow in the notes. It tells you reading on page 43 to 44, and vowels and consonants in General American. Remember that what we're seeing is actually not anywhere. This intricate session is about something that is not collected in the notes, and it's a sort of extension to the information that we already studying in the book. But at the same time, it's very important because it helps us contrast from a different perspective, from the prosodic perspective of General American and Archaic English. Since I haven't spoken to you in Aranoia, since I normally come here, the difference between Archaic English and General American, because we're set to deal with that, I think it's on the 20th. In the next class, I included some slides with the major features, and I'm going to, at the end of the session, give like a big rundown of elements of General American English. But I think it's interesting to focus the core of today's speech about informational factors. Informational factor, it is something that has to do with connected speech, and therefore it has to do with segments that surpass the syllable. We're going to go beyond the syllable. We're going to go into a region where we're talking about the super segments of spoken language, and in this case, in General American, we have to say that there are not enormous differences with Archaic English, and even more importantly, Archaic English has more differences with other Englishes that it shares in the British Isles, for example, than the different variations that you find within General American. So General American, to state it clearly, is much more uniform. Even though we don't focus on Canadian English because it's an optional accent in this course, I will say that Canadian English also follows that same dynamic. It is, in general, a homogeneous accent that has much less amount of varieties than other types of English. I get from different sources. Some of them are notes. Others are internet articles. For example, the TikTok epidemic, we're going to talk about what TikTok is. It's a specific mechanism that happens in American English, and this is very interesting because it links into other subjects like, for example, social linguistics, in the way that uptalking is considered something that affects especially women, and we're going to explain why it's an effect that happens especially to women. So we're going to explain what this uptalk means, and why it affects women, or why it is believed to affect women more than men. The uptalk epidemic, informational patterns in American English. Very recommendable website. I'm going to call it later. And I've added the link. This presentation is available for download in the recording and in the web conference. And on this link, phonetics.org, this specific static page is about American English, and it's an interactive page where it shows you intonational patterns of American English. So it's very useful. It's very useful patterns. And this specific article that extends on something explained by Cindy Barreiro very well, by the way, in the unit 3 notes on General American, of what this block T element is. We'll talk about that later on. Okay? So I want to start with the bibliography. This is the second part of the bibliography. Of course, besides international English, I also think Estela's book, I think it's a fundamental book because, as a matter of fact, this is the book that I use for the lingua inglesa, but this is the book that I used when I was studying filología inglesa. And I can tell you that our book, the book written by the literature, is much better and much easier to follow than this book that is considered one of the jewels of phonetics internationally. So I have to say, I was telling my Code of Affairs students the other day, this Gibson's pronunciation of English, even though Gibson's book is very good, Eva's book and Sylvia's notes, and also made some notes for her class, are incredible. I think they're probably one of the best compiled sources of English, and they're specifically focused for Spanish speakers, so it is especially useful, in my opinion, the way you should be going around studying this subject is using Sylvia's notes and extending in the Fragile Handbook wherever she says to, and maybe using as secondary references the two books that I talked about. Eva's book, which is very clear and is for all levels, and Gibson's book, which is maybe more advanced, but some of the basic stuff is not explained as explicitly and as simplistically as Eva and Sylvia do explain in their notes. So these two subjects are very lucky to have very good teachers. You should be using those outlets. I also took some notes on intonation in General American from another lecture in Islas Baleares, and some of the information is from here, and articles about what upspeak is, and I think that's all of these elements give you a lot of information about what we're going to be seeing today. Back to what we saw, there are so many things we can do in this class. I'm going to try to focus the conversation from a general perspective and go into detail. First, we're going to see what intonation is from a general perspective. I'm going to tell you where you can find more information if you wish to extend, but I think that for examination purposes, you have to understand in general what intonation is and how it fits within accents and why it's important to understand intonational differences in English, in American English. We're going to discuss whether intonation in General American is very different to Art English. We're going to talk about general intonational concepts, basically taking from two of them and simplify it for this purpose. We're going to open the Phonetica website and we're going to go over some of the general intonational patterns. We're going to specifically talk about American intonational pattern in that website that I talked about. We're going to talk about two effects that are specific from American pronunciation. The drop and the upspeak. I don't know if you have the opportunity to go through the exercises Professor Barreiro normally makes available, and if you listen to the audio, but I think it's a good moment to a play track number 8. The people that are at home are going to listen to it through the audio because I'm going to play it from the computer. And you're going to listen to it during class. If you have the practice photocopies for general American, it's on page 1 of the of this. Here, take my copy. I'll play that now. Okay. One moment. Let's see. Unit 3, General American, track number 8, okay? I'm going to play track number 8. If you have the practice file, it's on page 1 of the practice file, and it's like a 2-minute recording of an American speaker. Okay, well, that's all the way. We finish it with a simple ending. I'm going to read it because the people at home are telling me that they can't listen to the audio once it's streamed from the PC. I'm going to, of course, the cool thing about this is to be able to listen to a typical Mid-Eastern accent, which is the core American English accent. Is my accent American? It's American-ish. My education belongs to the West Coast, so my core English is Western, more than Eastern. So I have some of the nuances, and we'll talk about some of those nuances, what they are, that have to do with Western American English, which is one of the sub-varieties, we'll see that later, of American English. And the second situation that is deriving from that is that the same way that the speaker has been living in Sweden for, I think it's 40 years, I've been living in Spain for 30 years, because my parents are both Hispanic, my original English was very pure, and I have a very strong American accent. When I came here, I had the accent of a 10-year-old child. So all the English that I developed afterwards was more or less neutralized. So my accent is, I probably unconsciously eliminated a lot of the American features of my accent. to make myself more understandable for students that normally have British indicators or British prophet access to British audios. So I would recognize that my English is not as American as others. And there are some things, like for example, flaps, we're going to talk about that, those stops, that I try to avoid to make myself easier to understand for my students. When I'm talking to my brothers, or when I'm talking to friends from the United States, they would normally let go and have a more, let's say, native accent. But when I'm speaking in class, I have like a second accent that is my official working method accent. And even though it sounds American, it has some nuances that have neutralized it to make it easier to understand for everybody in general. So what he says, he talks about being in New York. He says, yeah, I grew up in New York on Long Island outside the city and spent all of my earlier years there. I was actually born in Chicago, but that's basically irrelevant. My parents were from New York, and so I grew up in New York. It was just after World War II, which meant that our town didn't have quite the distinctive accent it might have had. Our generation was a formative generation of children, but I was a typical New York kid, and I would have probably said New York. We're going to talk about that in New York, because there is a lack of rhoticity there. It's something very important to realize that even though we thought that we had reached general America and non-rhoticity was over, whether it was something of our English, and great idea is not. There are several accents in American English that are not welcome. I'm going to quickly describe which ones. Then I got to college and I became an English major, and my friend from Georgia told me the remarkable thing was that you stopped sounding like a New Yorker and you can't sound like a teacher. So normally, higher levels of education tend to smoothen accents in American English into five or six types of patterns. And sometimes social group that you belong to is going to be extremely relevant, for example, in the case of African Americans, to determine the way that you speak, regardless of the place where you are. Okay, so even though he is originally from New York, he has features in his English that are from the mainstream Mid-Eastern American English, that is what is considered GA. GA is that Mid-Eastern accent, and we're going to see that in a second. All of whom were working in New England, they were by no means all sounded like New Englanders. And that's the way things more or less stayed throughout my college years. And then I basically left the United States. So I've been back to teach occasionally, but I've been living for 40 years abroad in Sweden. And the extent to which that has affected my English is hard to be sure. I tried early. It's hard to keep a reasonable, East Coast sort of accent. Same thing in my case. And it's clearly different now when I imitate being back in the early when I talk to my relatives. But I do not think of myself very difficult, and I don't think I sound all that different. So, first thing we have to acknowledge is that accent is deeply affected by the place where we live and by the. We'll pass this for a second. Yeah, okay. The accent is affected by the place where I live, and also by the period where the English accent is normally fixed, which is during your educational year. Your accent is normally fixed that in those periods. So let's go. What is American accent? What is a general American accent? General American accent is this accent. Central Eastern. That is considered the core a general American accent. And from the perspective of location, it's something like this. Not very clearly where it is, because there aren't clear marked boundaries, like it's probably easier to determine in RP English regarding different accents of the United Kingdom. Okay, what we do have is we have huge territories of varieties of English. You can see the specific features, and I'm not going to fall into this very much on pages 45 to 53, I think it is. Yes, 53 of the book, where it talks about New York English as being a specific type of Northeastern English. Boston English being a specific subtype of Eastern New England English. Bad news. Both of these are non-Rock. Meaning that people from New York, as you can see in this exercise, would typically say New York. But people from Boston have an even more complicated accent, and they tend to have like an aspiration at the end of every syllable. Therefore, wiping out all the R's that are present and simplifying vowels in a tremendous way. For example, the very common word harbor in Boston English would be something like hollow. Hollow. Okay? So this would turn into a ah. Bob. Okay? And that particularity makes Eastern New England English, specifically the one spoken in Boston, and New York English, like antiques within the American English accent. Why does this happen? It is believed that because of the commercial influence with RP English. There was something halfway between the things that were taking place in American English and many of the things that they were hearing from the people coming and going to England and the British Isles. Is that the only non-Rockic variety of English? No, the Southern accents are also non-Rockic. Both lower Southern England, American English, and inland Southern accents are non-Rockic. They are non-Rockic. It is also believed because they are heavily present, they had a heavy trade presence, and therefore more interaction with international customers, and therefore they were exposed to not only the English that were spoken in Brazil, but also the English from the West Indies. So this transaction of conversations has a huge influence on the accent. As you can see, there is a wiping area over here, but only the middle remains, and all the rest is like protected. It's enveloped from the non-rusticity of RP English. So all of these accents are going to be locked. Okay, and all the typical effects that non-rusticity has in connected speech are not going to exist. So we're going to include R's, we're going to include certain elements that have to do with how American English sounds, differentiates it from RP English, and what we're going to see is that the more we go towards the West, the more different the accent is going to be to RP English, and there is a reasonable reason. There is less influence, or let's say cross-contamination, which right now is something very common, but maybe 200 years ago was very, very rare, and therefore it was very easy to protect the accent and have a pure accent in areas, also in Canada, in the western areas, northern areas, and inland areas. Therefore, for an American, it is probably easier to recognize people as New Yorkers or as Bostoners or Southerners than to recognize a Canadian. Because Canadians, in general, Canadian sounds very much like certain varieties of American English. So, from the point of view, depending on the way that the person talks, it can be even indistinct from some varieties of American English. So Canadian tends to mesh into the Rocky City that other varieties have. I mentioned Eastern New England, New York, lower Southern accent, inland Southern accent, black varieties. There is a social linguistic element that is very important to understand. In the 1920s, there was a huge migration of black people from the impoverished South that was still recovering from the Civil War. You probably studied about this, those are locals, to the North. Okay? It's called the North Migration. And all of these people went to cities such as Kansas City, St. Louis, Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, etc., etc. People that belong to black society, especially in the United States, especially until the pre-70s, had very little or no interaction with white people. Therefore, there was a preservational effect over their language. They spoke in the same way that their ancestors had spoken in the South, and they took their accent along with them, not acquiring the accent that they saw in the place where they would settle. Therefore, even though black varieties of English as spoken by African Americans have evolved and right now are more similar to other elements of English and also have a huge influence over general America, right now they still preserve some of the features from the South. Okay, so from an accent distribution point of view, what I wanted to open the class with was like a general overview of what we're going to find when we think about general American English. It's going to give us like a very overall perspective. Okay, so from the subject that we studied as pronunciación en lengua inglesa, what information do we receive about intonation? When we talk about intonation, we're talking about pitch. We're talking about changes in the pitch. Right now, for me, it's very difficult to change the pitch very much because I'm almost screaming to make people understand me from where the microphone is. But when people utter normal sentences, they normally don't do it at very loud voice. I do because I'm not particularly a quiet person, but in general, and when people speak, there is an intonation that it gives the listener information about many things, and we've seen this probably in semantics and social linguistics. Through the way that the sentence is intoned, or the different stress peaks of the sentence happen, whether the intonation rises or the intonation falls, we're going to have information like he's affirming something, he's asserting something, he's asking about something, he's not very sure about something, he's commanding something. Okay, so intonation is a very powerful instrument to define the type of utterance that we're singing. And in general, English, it uses intonation in a very clear-cut fashion for these purposes. Okay? Pitch change has normally three purposes, and I've more or less talked about them. Signal the divisions of utterances into intonational features. If I say, Ricky the teacher, Pilar's students, and this. Ricky the teacher, Pilar's students. I started up and I went down. I started up again and I went down. What did I do with that intonational pattern? I divided sentences first. And I indicated the listener what type of sentence I was saying. I was saying a certain sentence, which is classical of a fall. When I use a fall, it means that I am claiming something. And I'm pretty sure that that is true. Pilar is a student. Ricky is a teacher. And I start up and I go down. Okay? It therefore divides utterances into intonational phrases that normally have to do with full sentences. But the whole is, for example, that sometimes when I have fact questions, I have a typical tag questions to ask. You are understanding what I say, aren't you? You are understanding what I say, aren't you? That first draw is I'm trying to send a sentence and then I'm confirming that information. So this rise is normally indicating a part of, this is a full sentence, but this is a type of sentence that has this blueprint that indicates that it's normally going to be a question where I'm asking for a confirmation. Okay? So it's going to signal things like this. Intonational phrases that don't have to necessarily be sentences. They can be parts of the sentence. They can signal syllables with primary and secondary accents. I'm terrible with examples. I think it's my biggest flaw. But I'm very happy to have been researching for a very good example from Krugman's book. It is a very good example. Okay, so every book has a different element that is fantastic. Okay, so let me change the role to the board. The sentence. Okay, so here we have three sentences. No, he couldn't be seen. He was running. Okay, I don't know if you've watched any of the other web conferences. I don't remember if the other web conferences that talk about information are from this year or from previous years, because I've been watching a few and I can't recall which are from one year or which are from the other. In general, when we talk about intonation, there are three types of candidates to be the primary accent of a sentence, the primary stress. The primary stress is normally either a verb, or a noun, or an adjective. Those are the firm candidates for being the highest point in the sentence. In this case, when I assert something, I have to glide down, I have to fall, it would be like, no. I start very high, and the O is dropping, like, no. The second one, where would the stress be? Normally my stress, especially in modal verbs, especially when the modal verb is negative, is that my primary stress is going to be in the modal verb that confirms that something is not possible. And there's going to be secondary stress, not at the same level, but also in the sentence that the verb seen, the main verb. Okay? So I would say, he couldn't be seen. Or maybe even worse. reckless. He couldn't be seen. Okay, so I rise up to the couldn't, then I lower to the be, and then I rise in the love so much to the seeing. So this is my secondary stress. And this is my primary stress. In this sentence, it's a past continuous. And was has no importance for the understanding of the sentence, but what was. It's not the same to say he was running, that he was escaping from the police. So the primary stress of the sentence that has only one peak is going to be running. He was running. He was running. Okay? So it's now, he couldn't be seen. He was running. And what's the problem that the Spanish speakers have? That these intonational patterns are different in Spanish. And where you put the importance is different. And why you would pronounce it one way or the other, that intonation is very good. It's very different in Spanish than in English. Elias Canas wrote from Teach Yourself English Pronunciation. It is a fantastic textbook for checking that out. I don't know if you have that book. If you haven't checked the date, if you don't have it, pick it up from the library because it's part of your Yamasitas in every library. And you will notice that there's a fantastic explanation between how you do things in Spanish and how you do things in English. And pronouncing in the way you pronounce in Spanish, using English in the same way, you can lead to either misunderstanding or misinterpretation. People would either not understand what you're saying, thinking that you're asking a question when you're not, or they would believe that maybe you have no interest in what you're saying because you're using the Spanish intonational pattern. So access to that is important. Back to where we were. It also shapes pitch changes that convey different things. It shapes the tune. When we were seeing Scottish English and Irish English, I remember people that are at home also studying Scottish English, Irish English. I think they are special because the vowels are so open. There is a huge musicality to the accent. Well, that's what we're talking about when we refer to the tune of an accent. Okay? Every language has a different tune, or every accent, sorry, has a different tune that normally the way that the vowels in contrast with the consonants create a natural musicality to the accent, the same way that Scottish English and Irish English are very up and down in the pitch and in the musicality. Also, a typical accent produces a meaning. Okay, what I was talking about. You are going to come, aren't you? But what if I say you are going to come, aren't you? Okay, I've changed my intonation. The only thing I've changed is my pitch. If I see the transcription, both transcriptions would be different. But the message, the meaning, the discourse marker would be different. Probably the attitude that you find in the listener would be different. You would say, wow, he's angry and I don't know why. Okay? So that's why intonation is very important. Okay? And some of the things that Daryl Merrigan has that are specific to American English, have a huge difference between what we do in our meetings and what we do in general American. The most difficult area of intonation for foreign learners is this, to distinguish the attitude difference. Okay? Distinguish from habit. So, is intonation in general American very different to intonation in RP? Well, no. There are relatively few differences in intonation. And in fact, what I was saying before, we have more informational differences between RP and other accents from the north of England than we have between RP and General American. So, why are we talking about intonation at all? Why are we using intercompany session for intonation in General American? Because it's going to give you dead knowledge. It's going to give you the capacity to see beyond the segment, see beyond the word and the consonants and the vowel that are very important to understand, but understanding longer segments, understanding connected speech is also very important to understand. Some differences, the slope of the rise and fall accent also exhibits great difference. British speakers tend to speak with lower pitch, but higher pitch change rate, especially in the rise accent. This is from Queen Gadi Saidi Asegi in a 2002 scholar paper. Certain patterns in English may be favored by most Americans than most GP speakers, and vice versa. This means that one of the biggest battlegrounds for linguists is to establish something as common knowledge that everybody accepts. For example, you say rhoticity, not rocking, not qualisense. Those other things that have to do with the word. Everybody seems to agree, or the immense majority seems to agree on which languages apply, which consonant or vowel uses to its variety of English. But in intonational issues, first, there is a lot more ethnicity, there's a lot more variety, and therefore, there is hardly any consensus. The only thing that I'm going to mention are the things that most people tend to believe as demonstrated so far. Okay? Remember, very important, another super segmental and prosodic feature that General American has is that there is a general nasal quality in their speech. Vowels are nasalized even when they are not next to a nasal consonant. And when I'm speaking in British English, in RP, and I'm saying, rain the minutes. Okay, and the intonation drops. I was to say this in General American, I would say, it will rain in a minute. If I exaggerate my accent and I speak more like somebody from the Mid-Eastern, it will rain in a minute. Everything is nasal in the way I'm saying that. Okay? Let me clean the accent and say again, it will rain in a minute. Okay, first the pitch is lower, so the pitch in American is going to be higher, but the jump is probably more contrasted in British English because I have a very low to a medium. It'll rain in a minute. And whereas in American English, I'm going to have a higher pitch, it'll rain in a minute. Okay, there's hardly a bump, and my starting pitch is higher. That's typical of American English. So if you want to take a key takeaway from difference between RP English and General American, a first takeaway would be where the pitch starts. The pitch starts at a higher point in General American than it starts in British. To say it another way, English speakers sound more polite and calm than American speakers that maybe sound loud from the start. Okay, so even though there are an enormous variety of voices and ways of speaking, that generally applies to everybody. A general intonational concept. Intonation is a super segmental feature. Now, verb denotatives are candidates to receive stress highs as they are relevant parts of the utterance. And we have two ways of uttering a sentence or uttering a segment of speech. We either rise from a low point to a high point, sometimes called a glide, okay, or we fall. And that's normally called a draw. Okay? So, we have draw, and we have glide. Okay? As secondary features. In Gibson's book, you have a lot of information about informational patterns that apply to every type of English, and you can find this in Gibson's book. That's in 11. It starts in page 207. But, in my opinion, the complexity of information here goes beyond the scope of the course. So I will only use it as a general reading to gain more knowledge about it, but stick to the information that Silvia Barreiro provides in unit 3. Actually, there is very little said about information. It's not very much. And false are assertive in general. That's another key takeaway. We're talking about that. It's time for lunch. I'm going to sleep. It's 3 o'clock. Okay? It's very clear. Rises are used for questions in general. Do you understand? Are these your keys? Is this your wallet? Okay? So we have fall, assertive, rise, question. Easy. No. American English makes it complicated. Why have something easy when you can have something complicated? Well, first of all, I'm going to open this link. I'm going to add the link to people at home so they can check and follow this phonetics.org link. I think it's not going to let me. Let me see. Let me find the. Okay, I think it's intonation. Yeah, this one. I love this one. Well, let me first copy this for the people at home because before I think it was Anna told me that you can't listen to the audio when I play it here. I'm going to play the different audios in this URL. You can copy it in at home and open it in your computers. It's something worth bookmarking. Let me see if I can activate this. Yes. Okay. So what we basically have here is a hover feature that whenever you hover over a sentence, it utters the correct intonation. So this is an assertion, and it's going to be a fall. This is an assertion with a confirmation question. Okay? So it's a tag question. She is married, isn't she? First there's a fall, and then there's a rise. Okay. Now the contrary. You want to negate something and then ask for a confirmation over a negative question. To distinguish it from she's married, isn't she? The opposite would have the opposite intonational mark. She isn't married, is she? So, let me... Okay, now we got it. I don't know if the people at home are listening to it. I hope they are. The next one is a typical question. And as we said, with questions, it's going to be a rise.
Would you like some? And now, two sentences that are just answers, therefore they're false. Okay, yes please, no thank you. Now, flats. Flats are not very common, but they also happen. When you want to emphasize, you make a flat instead of making a drop that asserts, and you make a flat, you're changing the mark, the intonational mark, and therefore something is happening. Okay, so people notice that there is a different attitude in the speaker, and they make an interpretation over that discourse marker that is the intonational mark. Yes, please. Different too. Yes, please. Okay? No thanks. That's a typical fault. And now, something that would have the peak in the main verb of a modal verb that is in affirmative mode, in positive mode, and there is an up and down movement to indicate that the main stress, the primary stress, is going to be in love. I love some. Okay? And now, when you really want to emphasize, like saying, no, you're wrong there, and you say you're wrong there, and you want to say it with a sentence such as, excuse me, you're really telling the person, stop. Okay? There is much more message than what you're just saying with two words. And that's what intonation is doing. Okay? Excuse me. Okay? Sorry. Typical fall when you're just asserting. You stepped on someone, sorry. But what if you don't understand something? Sorry? Sorry, it rises. Now a flat one. Cool. Okay? And now you want to you want to make that one stand out, so it would be more of a typical rise, but from a higher position. What would you do with an exclamation? Whenever you have an exclamation, you rise the pitch even more. Okay, so. Okay. Great website. It has examples of American English vowels, consonants, diphthongs, triphthongs, and also for other types of English. I really recommend you using phonetics.org. It's a great website. Okay? I don't know if the people at home were able to follow. Yes? Okay, great. They were listening to it, so that's good. Let's see. Let's go back here. When would we float? When would we fall? This is like the classical way of creating the intonation. We're going to fall. Those statements, John's attention. The WH question is different to the one where we're confirming, when we're adding an attack question. What's the time? Commands, stand up. Tell me what happens with a command is that you start at a higher routine. Stand up. Okay? Because stand up. Stand up. Okay, you rise the pitch up here because you really want the curve, you want the emphasis. What do you want to use? You raise the pitch. Okay? And it drops to the same point, so it emerges as well. There's an extra, this is a plus of the message. This is how angry I am. Okay? That's the difference. Exclamation. What a relief. You lost the 5 euro bill. You lost the 50 euro bill. What a relief. Okay, so the difference in pitch that indicate the importance that you're giving to a statement. Question tags, expecting agreement. The food tastes nice. Food tastes nice. Okay? Rises. Simple rises or fall rises. It can be simple, or it can be something that falls and rises. Okay? Normally it's a continuative sentence, it's an implicative sentence, and it's normally non-assertive. Non-assertive, very important. What does non-assertive mean? It means, I'm not sure of what I'm saying, I'm testing. Do you understand me? And this is the difference.
I see the other guy get on his face, and they look very confident. They're taking notes. They're coming up, and I'm saying they do understand me. They do understand me. But I see they're scratching their head. They're looking through the notes, and so I change the information. I say, "Do you understand me?" Okay, and that's the difference. And if that difference exists, it's very relevant. Okay, because it's going to send message that exceeds the amount of words that I'm saying, in the way that it's giving, maybe it's also giving you information about my confidence, okay, my confidence in myself. Okay, if I'm always speaking in this non-assertive way, it's probably because I'm not very confident in the message that I'm trying to send across. They appear in the clarity showing uncertainty. This is all wrong. This is all wrong. I know that. But when you're, this is all wrong. What's the matter with you? Okay? That can buy me love. WH, questions showing interest or deep sympathy. How much did you gain? How much did you gain? Okay, let's say, wow, you missed a flight. I have to buy another ticket. How much did you pay? What I'm doing now is very American. And we're going to speak about this in 2 slides. It's called upspeaking. It's a very typical American English intonational mark. One of the two American English intonational marks. Upspeaking means to speak like this all the time, rising all the time. Why would I do this? Probably because I'm not very sure about what I'm saying. Or, in this case, because it's a fashion. It's a language fashion that has other fashion. It's just something that gets into the language, and there's no way of getting it out. And we're going to see. There's an article in the bibliography that says when something the title is by a psychologist saying when will this upspeaking end? So I say I'm sick of it. Everything sounds like a question. Okay, so it's very interesting that linguists and even psychologists are trying to read between lines as why an entire a country would suddenly change the informational patterns or the language because it's stating something different. That when they speak, the person that is speaking is not giving things for granted. There are no assertions. Everything is questionable. Everything is open for debate. And this is so serious that even a president like George W. Bush intended to speak in his presidential speeches using uprising during the whole speech. Something that at first was something that maybe belonged to an age group, maybe belonged to a certain area, is considered to be a feature that began in Western American English, and extended to the rest of the varieties of American English, and right now it's a key feature of American English, and a very famous linguist, Robin Lahoff, you probably remember Robin Lahoff from Semantics, has a theory that has to do with feminism, about why people love speaking verb. We're going to see that later. Another issue that has to do with writing, expressions of reassurance and encouragement. It's all right. You won't fail. Okay? Or you won't fall. That's what I said. The best. You won't fall. Or reassurance. Yes, please. No, thank you. Okay? This rise is something that is when the speaker is able to voluntarily change and even flip. Go from a fall or an assertion to a rise, even when it's not the most natural way to go. Expressions of disagreement. We haven't got any time. We haven't got any time. Yes, we have. Yes, we have. Somebody says something, and you don't agree. And I didn't do my homework. Yes, you did. I do remember. It's under your folder, okay? So that expression of disagreement, a way of uttering it, is to rise instead of fall. You're assertive, but you disagree. Okay? So it's a different type of assertion. Neutral question tags. It's like, isn't it? It's like, isn't it? Level tone. That means that it's a flat. And it's considered that even that up to 40% of English could be a level. Okay? The upspeak. This is one of the two intonational marks of general American. Even though assertions to cut out the sentences are mainly falling, there's a tendency in general American to have a rising in the declarative sentences. So a phenomenon that has been studied and it happens more in general American. Is it only in American English? No. It happens in Australian English. In Australian English, it's confined or it's starting within the younger Australian speakers. So the younger Australian speaker you have would mimic the way their parents spoke, and all of their sentences would sound like questions. Okay, like they weren't very sure what they were saying. And it is in fact so extended that through apparently, I noticed in my real life, British television viewers are huge fans of Australian soap operas. We, in Spain, we watch them as well as soap operas. Apparently, in Great Britain, they watch Australian soap operas. This has become so, common that in Great Britain, known as the Australian highways. Okay, so it's a way that British people believe that Australian young people speak. So just through watching Australian teenage soap operas. And in fact, this has also occurred in the United States. It used to be called, it has something with sexist. Valley Girl Complex. And it's considered to have stemmed in California, and it's been very intensely studied by scholars of universities from the West Coast, such as Berkeley, which has some remarkable linguistic example of Hoff. And I don't know if it's in this one or in the next slide, but it's in the next slide. Where Lacan gives her explanation of why she thinks this is happening. English is normally marked by a high tone, a high pitch, or a high fundamental frequency that begins in the final accented syllable. So, normally, the way of seeing where the primary accent in a sentence is the last word of the last lexical word of a sentence, and from there it follows. Okay, that's a normal way. But in this case, from that lexical word right. I just do that. Okay? That last lexical word rises. Okay? I'm indicating a difference. Psychologist Jack Davis describes it as an ever-growing tendency to end statements with upward inflections to make them sound like questions. Like you're not quite sure what you're saying. Or clear, or will it be acceptable to your audience? Okay? So, do you understand? Are you sure about this? Am I being clear? That's what I'm talking about. That's the upspeak. Okay, so that's the upspeak or high rise is something that began as, let's say, a teenage young speaker movement and has affected the whole language, the whole accent, the whole American English accent. This phenomenon may indicate social standing, okay? My position versus the person I'm speaking to, social power struggle, like I don't feel that I have the same authority as the person I'm talking to. Okay? I don't know if you understand what I'm saying, okay? That type of thing. I'm like asking for permission, I'm being quite polite. I'm trying to mark the distance. And trying to, that's what I'm talking about. Okay. When you go back and watch your favorite American television series, and you switch to your favorite British series, you will see that in American series, many characters, maybe all of them, tend to do this. Most in sentences. And in fact, when you listen to President Obama, every time he wants to make a point, he upstates. It's time for union. It's time for the people of America to unite. I want you to go back, listen to President Obama and see how he upstates. He upstates as a way of connecting to his audience. And not as a way of not for the church. Because he is so assertive with his nonverbal language, even though he sounds, if you isolate the voices and the study is not very sure what he's saying, but since that is normally accompanied by his very self-assuring presence, it counteracts with what he says. Okay, so when you listen to President Obama, it's a great example of a typical example of our speaking. Linguist Robert McCuff thinks that the origin comes from the 60s. It comes from a gender point of view of women approaching language in a different way than the way men approach language. That men are very aggressive in many things, and also in the way that they speak as if they were commanded. Having finished a report, I said, wow. He wants me to leave whatever I'm doing to this at the court. And if I'm a boss that wants to sound nice, and they walk up to me and say, I can use that report. I say, I'm open to a no. Not that I want it, but I'm open to it. Okay, so that's what you're doing with your speech. That's very important. And there are two conflicting demands. To provide information with confidence on the one hand, but to do it with a non-imposing, non-bossy, ladylike way. Okay? And this is Lacoste's word. Bossy people tell you how it is. Bossy day, people day. Today is Monday. If you want to be non-bossy, you say, today is Monday. It's almost like it was a question, but you're just raising the pitch. And if you will get in here say, okay, I know it's Monday, but I don't want to sound like I'm giving you a deadline. It's like, today's Monday, you know, we have to send that report to the customer who's expecting it. You hear that? It's like typical managerial style where you want to be like sort of buddy with your with the people that work for you. And so you get into this tone, you know what I mean? Sounds very American. So now you know why it sounds American. Because everybody uses it for everything. Bush started using it for politics. Obama using it for politics. I'm using it to explain upstream. Okay? So that's the way that things get, that upstream works. I hope it was clear. This is one of the key takeaways that you want to go away with. The draw. Okay? This is weird. It's the opposite. It's a sudden fall in the pitch. And when do we have that fall? It is more favored in general American than in British. And British would use all rise. They typical British ways of saying goodbye. Whoops. Cheers. Not very clear, but cheerio. What? So long. Okay. Farewell. Okay, it sounds like the sound of music. What do Americans do? See you. See, that's different. So long. See you. It's so exaggerated that they do this effect that you can see in Trudgill and Hannah on page 86. It's a very interesting thing because it's very typical of American English to adapt the spelling to the way you want it pronounced. For example, you say, tonight, you avoid the standard spelling because you think people are going to understand it better like that. Of course, with bending the language, like right, saying gonna or wanna. Some examples here are questionable. The first one is very simple. I don't understand a bit of that. But for example, saying low, though, through, crossing, this, they even use this on street signs. Okay? So, the way they've adapted this to what sets it off is, for example, they would change from CU to CU because it's easier to follow with an A. So, if you say, CU, you have lower vowels than CU. They need to drop even more acutely. Okay, so I think it's a very interesting element, and it's also typical from American English. So upstick on one hand, drop on the other. Intonational markers of American English. And before we finish, what time is it? We have 10 more minutes. I wanted us to go over the basic things that American English it has. We know we're going to have another tutorial session about American English. We're going to develop this thing a wider way and talk about grammar distinctions and syntactic distinctions and stress in specific words. I think that now that we have some guests from across Spain, it would be a very interesting idea to point out the key differences in the key features of American English in the biggest areas. The accents, the type of accent, we saw that at the beginning of the class, the vowels and the consonants, and other segmental differences, phonotactic features. First thing that has to be said is that vowels in general American English, general American, are one of the huge battlegrounds of linguists nowadays. There is very little consensus about the appropriate way to describe American English vowels. My recommendation in this case is take Sylvia's notes by heart, and do the transcription following her patterns, because you read one book, you see one thing, you read another book, you see a slightly different thing, you see another one, you see a different one. Yeah, she has a great chart on page 3, 4, and 5 of the notes. Probably the biggest collection of generally accepted consensus of the typical mechanism. What we see is that the long vowels tend to shorten, and there is a very subtle difference between a long vowel and a short vowel. Okay? So the vowel contrast is harder to understand. There's a tendency, and there are two contradictory tendencies. Short vowels are lengthening, and therefore, there is a loss of distinctive duration between long and short vowels. Okay? Vowels are based on the quality of the vowels rather than on the length. Okay? In British English, in RP English, vocality is built upon vowel length. Since general American is Gothic, it doesn't have that necessity to depend on the length of the vowels being very accurate. Therefore, it can use some mechanisms. There is a movement such as the British Hawk that does not exist in America. It doesn't exist. And it is mostly substituted by pa, or sometimes by po. Okay? This is the key feature. This phoneme does not exist in GA. All GA vowels are characterized by R coloring. What does R coloring mean? It means that the R is everywhere and it's present in the rhotic varieties. It is much more present. And it affects the quality of the vowels that surround the R. And therefore, some of the effects that RP has over the R's, like the R being transferred from one word to the other, depending on the second syllable or the following syllable, those do not exist in general area. This effect, our coloring, I think you can find that. It's explained, not in the best way possible, but it's not a bad explanation. Silvia's is a bit better. You can see that on the page. It's 43. Yeah. Being wrong in North American English have R and bar. It notes the lack of RP. The O, for the A, and the distinction, it means that the words like coming from point G on page 43. Note the lack of the RP. O, it changed to that. The A distinction means that car and card are distinguished only by means of the R. Card and card. I don't pronounce it exactly like that, but there is another effect in Western English that doesn't apply to it. You can read afterwards in the varieties of American English. This distinction is not general for all types of English. We have to go with some of them. Well, sorry and sorry are perfect rhymes in American English. The rhoticity of point 3, the rhoticity of North American English has a consequence that the following RP vowels derived historically from vowel plus R did not occur in North American English. The ia as the diphthongs that normally RP English page 44. Yes, page 44, point 3. The rhoticity of North American English has a consequence that the following RP vowels derived historically from vowel plus R did not occur in North American English. We remember that we added schwas in the diphthong to provide the same sound that we needed to release that missing R in the non-rhotic RP. In RP English, we would say via, with that diphthong. That diphthong disappears in those type of words, and we have here. Shorter in one vowel audio. It changes from E to E. It changes from E to E to air. There. Second word. It changes from tour to turn. Turn. It's like a simplification. Same thing we saw in Southern Irish English. That's why sometimes Southern Irish English reminds many things. The bird, it changes to bird. Okay? So we have all those effects that are the consequence of the logicity of American English versus the non-logicity of RP. Very quickly over the consonants, the consonantal system of RP English and General American do not differ very much. The overall number of consonants is the same in the two accents, with the exception of the presence of the aspirated W, the what? In some of the English accents, for example, I don't speak like that. So it creates this contrast, for example. Some people in American English say where and where. Where? 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 It's like a W with an aspiration right after it. Where? Okay? It's an aspirated W. Only in some places. More about consonants. The T, this is from Sylvia's notes, so you can extend either here or Sylvia Larrea's notes because they're fantastic. The T in General American can be pronounced in many ways. You can have the global replacement of the T or locally, and I'm going to look for examples. Yeah, you want to have a L right after. Button. When I say button. Button. Oops. Yeah. So it would be schwa, the global stop, and then button, button, button. Okay? This tappy, and very important, there is a dual way of calling this. It can be called tappy or flapping. Trudgill and Hannah call it flapping. Okay? The tapping means changing the T to a D sound. For example, I normally, when I speak to students, I avoid this. When I speak to my family, I use it. Okay? So when I speak to you, I say better. When I speak to my family, I say better. Better. It's a very soft D. Okay? There is a replacement of the D for a D. Intervocalic is better. Butter. Butter. I can say it right, yes, but when I'm in connected speech, I will normally use that. Our tends to be pronounced as an approximant with great reflection. That means that it's heavily pronounced. It has some examples here. Like kernel, 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 kernel. Okay, this is a retroflexion. Okay, the L tends to be darkened before it starts vowels, but when it's in a front vowel, sorry, when it's in a front syllable and it's an opener, there is a yod quiescence later, clearer, later. Absence of vocal reinforcement before a voiceless operant consonant, such as ta 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 and cha. We finish. Okay, talk about the varieties of different accents. Elements that we have to take into consideration is the presence of the er in General American that does not normally occur in pre-consonant appearances in RP. It doesn't ever occur. You can read more about this. They're very well explained. There's a lot of examples. And the yod dropping talks about places where I drop the yod phoneme and places where I add it. Okay? the Yochanim or are added, and in the zone of the three. I think that's it. Yes, the rest is the bibliography where I take in the notes on the information, and then I'll be able to put the questions. Well, thank you very much. I hope you found it useful. And it's a different perspective than studying the different acts one by one. And the next couple of them will go back to seeing General America who wrote 16 to be signed the last 4 slides, but in a slower way and stopping the examples. Thank you very much to everybody that watched this afterwards and that's watched it from home. And have a great evening.